Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal profession. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So we have a great episode this week to recognize September and October being Suicide Awareness Month and Mental Health Awareness Month, respectively. Now, I did want to put a disclaimer, a warning up front here that we are going to be dealing with some sensitive issues on this episode that some of you may not be comfortable with hearing at this point, but we just want to let you know you may want to skip this one, but it will be here when and if you are ready for it. So, Marlene, I'll let you introduce our guest today.
We have three fantastic guests this week. Saskia Melhorn, our fellow Houstonian, who's the Director of Knowledge and Research Services at Norton Rose Fulbright. Nita Comello, Global Client Director and Director of Well-Being, Global Large Law Firms at Thomson Reuters. And Bree Buchanan, Senior Advisor at Krill Strategies, LLC, and co-founder of the Well-Being in Law Movement. Saskia, Nita, and Bree, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, good to have all three of you here. So before we get started, Bree, I want you to kind of line us up here and get us all on the same page. Can you start off by explaining what you mean when you talk about well-being, when you talk to your clients and when you talk to the audience to whom you present?
Great question to start us off, Greg, and thank you for having me here. When there was a group of folks who came together in 2016 that we really paid a lot of attention to these issues, we wrote that National Task Force report that really changed things so much. And the first thing we knew we had to do was define the terms. We had to define what does well-being mean when we talk about that. And so one of the things we looked at is the World Health Organization's definition of it. But ultimately, what we came up in regards to well-being, there are six dimensions of well-being: mental, emotional, occupational, spiritual, physical. So there's the piece of that which is applicable for everybody in the legal profession. Another piece of that well-being definition includes helping those of us, like me, who developed alcohol use disorders or depression or anxiety, and make sure that we get resources and help to them as well.
Nita, you have survey information on the topic of well-being. And in fact, you have a brand new survey that you've completed and released this month. Would you cover what types of statistics that you've pulled together on the issue of well-being and mental health in the legal industry?
Sure. And I want to clarify that it's actually not a survey that Thomson Reuters put out. It's a survey that one of our partners at Unmind put out. And I'm happy to talk about that. I'd also, if you don't mind, I'd love to take just a couple of seconds and maybe piggyback off of what Bree said about what well-being means, because I think that
please do.
There's what well-being means sort of generally, and then, you know, what well-being means for the legal industry. And, you know, I kind of have a lot of thoughts about what well-being means for the legal industry, and I kind of feel like I'm constantly evolving my position of this. For a long time, I would often say things like, I'm so passionate about well-being and that well-being is really kind of foundational to, you know, future of work because it enables for the optimization and empowerment of people to endure and thrive in a world that is just so dynamically changing and transforming like the legal industry. And it is, and I maintain this position still very fervently, but I also think it's not really enough to just communicate it in this way. I think what well-being means for the legal industry, you know, right now in this particular moment is really more about enabling a future, you know, for lawyers and for legal professionals in which we don't, I think, over-rotate on any one specific concept, like the importance of technology, for example, and what can be used to like replace us or make us more efficient in the ways that we work. I think that well-being is really foundational for us to develop, you know, human skills and competencies in ways that the things that we really focus on a lot, like in technology, won't be able to replicate. And those are things like creativity, like empathy, like adaptability or critical thinking or connection. And I think that these are skills that are just so important for legal professionals and the value that they bring going forward in a world that is so dominated by AI and technology. And I think as an industry, we have to be really mindful and intentional about how we nurture and develop these skills for individuals, but also for teams and for firms and organizations as a whole. It's actually in that vein that I was really excited to read, and I'm happy to kind of promote and share the statistics, Marlene, that you mentioned, that our friends at Unmind actually just released a new report September 28th on the state of well-being in the law. And I think what this report does is it draws attention to and highlights like the impact of well-being and I guess the perceived support of well-being on performance in the legal sector. And, you know, their stated objectives in the report or in the survey that they conducted were really to kind of do three things. They were trying to understand workplace well-being. They were trying to measure financial impact, and they're also trying to benchmark well-being within the legal sector. So some of the stats that really stood out to me, I think it's important to note that they worked with six very large firms in the United States. They collected data from over 3,800 lawyers and professionals, and they captured across eight dimensions that impact workplace well-being and mental health. Some of the key stats that really stood out to me: 52% of employees have taken at least one day off in the last quarter due to mental health difficulties. And why this is important to me is the underlying message that this should really signal to us and to anyone running a law firm right now or any organization. If more than half of the people are struggling with mental health difficulties enough that it forces them to take time away from work, it means that there are even more days spent where they are operating in a negative or a stressed or, in best case, state of neutral headspace. And we know that if you're operating in that negative, stressed or neutral, that you're definitely not optimating in an optimal headspace or at peak performance. And that is a problem, you know, for organizations like law firms that thrive on having a competitive advantage, for delivering a high level of client service, for having fulfillment amongst their lawyers and their employees, you know, for a whole host of reasons. Another stat that stood out to me is that over a third of respondents said that they don't feel that their firm is committed to supporting their mental health. And to me, that's just unacceptable and something that doesn't really require too much lift to turn around, like, that perception. And finally, the last stat that I'll share from the report that I think should hit every stakeholder in the law firm in the gut is the estimated financial losses that are related to presenteeism, to absenteeism, to attrition that is related to well-being. The annual cost that they reported on average in this report was over $21 million a year for a firm. And the lowest scoring dimension that contributed to this in the study is the employee perception of senior leadership's commitment to well-being, because one in five people said that they don't trust that senior leaders and firms are making decisions that are in the best interest of their well-being. So in my view, these are all things that we can kind of, you know, work on through education, through training, through reducing stigma and focusing on human skills.
I wanted to follow up on the issue where you said one in five believe that the senior leadership at the firm, I'll word this in the wrong way, but essentially don't have the best interest of people, of their workers' mental health at issue. Do you think that's generational, that this is the older group that has, and again, this may be jumping a little bit, but we used to be very reactive when it came to how we dealt with this, and it was whether it was drug issues, alcohol issues, mental health issues. We waited until something kind of exploded before we did anything. And, you know, there's this whole idea of past generations kind of giving that, you know, we'll suck it up and move on. So do you think this is because you have a younger generation that has a different expectation to be more proactive on this rather than reactive? And also that, this may be oversimplification, is they have the language now to express what their expectations are. Am I kind of on the right path here?
I think so. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that there is a generational component to this. I mean, if you look at the breakdown of the folks who responded on the survey, I think that half of the respondents were made up of partners and associates, and half of the respondents were made up of the professional staff at the organization. So you can sort of make the determination that if a quarter of the folks are partners, that you're probably dealing with a slightly older generation, you know, generally speaking. But that said, you know, I think you're right. I do think that there's a generational demand. I also wouldn't attribute it entirely to that, because there was not a single one of us who was not impacted by going through and enduring a global pandemic where we were all forced to kind of reassess our personal priorities and what was important to every single one of us. And I think that this in and of itself created a bit of a movement and an awareness and an appreciation for doing the things that have meaning and purpose in our lives and how fundamental that is to a state of well-being.
I just find it really fascinating that, you know, that statistic about how, again, employees aren't feeling that their issues are being addressed, because firms spend, I don't even know how much money. I mean, you know, in wellness initiatives, I mean, all firms have them, all firms publicize them, and you know, it doesn't seem to be hitting the mark. So I'm wondering if anybody has any thoughts about that as to why that would be.
I think what I see in law firms is there is a lot of awareness about the value and importance of well-being and initiatives and resources by the HR department, by, you know, there may be some people in the management team who think about this, but a challenge that we're experiencing right now is really to get to the point where this awareness and concern is saturated through all levels of a law firm. Because what I see frequently, then you'll have a practice group or a team, and the leader of that is not bought in to this at all. It's like, yeah, those people can take vacations, but we're the top dogs and we don't take vacations.
We don't,
right?
Do that.
Yeah. And that undermines so much, right?
Well, and I think another thing then, and we all saw it through the pandemic, but we also saw it through the 2008 economic downturn, is that firms will do a lot of programs when times are good and throw money at it, throw time at it. But when times get tight, they tend to go right back to old habits. So I remember in 2008 having programs that were talking about how to better serve clients, and there was whole programs that were set up around it. And then as soon as the economy tanked, all of those programs went out the window and it went right back to what we knew. And so that wasn't a time to experiment with this. And so I wonder if some of the folks that are, you know, you said a third of them thought that their firms weren't helping, that they see these programs as window dressing and checking a box.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think that a lot of the sort of early action that we saw, particularly in the beginning of the pandemic, was that exactly what you said, Greg, like this check the box. You know, we signed the ABA pledge, we subsidized a gym membership, and, you know, check, we've like taken care of our well-being program. And, you know, I don't mean to minimize that those things are all important. I think that there's an element of a lot of the work or the investment that was made by so many organizations really put the onus upon the individual still to take advantage of whatever it was, or to make the time. But from an organizational or cultural level in the firm itself, nothing was actually changing. So, you know, how were they really dedicated to spending time developing people and, you know, helping them see a connection to their meaning and purpose, or creating a feeling of kind of collaboration and managerial support, like what Bree said, or role modeling, like those sort of organizational pillars of workplace health and well-being that don't put the onus upon the individual, but really where the organization takes some of that onus, is where I think the rubber meets the road, and where firms that do really well in those areas will probably see a better sentiment from their people, a more proactive approach.
Just to amplify what Nita was saying, because this is such a huge issue, the impression that there's window dressing, absolutely, when the what a firm offers, I refer to as sort of the fun runs and hot yoga view of well-being. And people see that. It's like, you're putting this on me. I don't have time to do all of this stuff because of the billable hours or whatever are the structures that are set up. We need the firm to make the change. That's the hard stuff, but that's what has got to happen for us to have systemic structural change in the profession.
Yeah, I like what you're pointing out about the, you know, the individual responsibility, because it seems like we have to go a little deeper. Like, we have to actually, relationships and sort of, you know, people touch has to be much more part of these types of programs, I think, to get the response that that law firms are looking for. Any thoughts on that?
I'm just going to pivot a little bit, because I understand that it's really sometimes the programs that are put on there more geared towards the physical well-being and eating healthy, living a good life, but in not going overboard. But one of the things that I think we all have to take on our own shoulders is that we need to talk about it, because there is a stigma about mental health and admitting that, that someone has mental health issues, that someone is not feeling up to par to what's put in front of them. And that is extremely difficult to talk about. And that has really not changed as much as the programs that are put out there. And I think it's a combination of really being in a position where you can do that. I think that partners have a better position there to really be the ones that vocalize it. I don't think you can expect from a junior associate that they say, well, I'm just, this is just too much for me. They will, there is this barrier, and it's extremely hard to admit. But then also those of us that are in business services and are in a more secured position where we don't have to be afraid to speak up and to bring this on, we also have to be the ones that are advocating for awareness and to really taking away the stigma.
Saskia, you actually raise a really good point that if people do speak up, then I think what often happens is, you know, either it's ignored, or, you know, everyone is like, oh, and then they treat them with kid gloves, but then the work never comes back. And because people are afraid to sort of address it, as you've said, and it's just kind of a vicious circle that way.
And it's hard to tell your story and break the stigma. It's one of the most critical things that we can do, because what's holding us back and what keeps people from getting help is the stigma that's around mental health. What we need to flip the story is that it's okay to have these problems, and it's the best thing you can do is access help as soon as possible. And the way we do that is expose people to someone who's had that experience, who's experienced depression, anxiety, a substance use disorder, and see, hey, that's a real person, and there's still a lawyer or something. And that's the kind of thing, slowly but surely, you can chip away at stigma. But it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. It takes a lot of courage.
Yeah. Well, I know all of you have personal stories, and you know, I know we want to take some time to talk about those and your experiences. So, Saskia, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you.
Thank you. I definitely have a personal story, and I'm really grateful that I can share it here. It took me about 2 weeks to get prepared for that. But
we are too.
My youngest son in 2019 died by suicide. And it was something that we did not see coming. And we knew that he had, that he didn't always feel well, but he was pushing it off. And I think part of that was also that stigma, because he was a very private person and he didn't want to share anything. And he probably felt that if he says anything, that he would be just put in a box. But so this moment that you never hope, the call that you get and where everything really breaks down, it is really as bad as you can imagine. And one of the first things that came into my mind, and that we were discussing as a family was, are we open about that? So this stigma right away came in where I was just, I was thinking about, well, do we even tell people that he died by suicide? Or do we say, well, heart attack, accident? And one of the things that it, or two things actually, that really stuck with me was, so my fear, it was very personal. It was then in that moment really about me. What will people think of me as a mother? Will that have make me a bad mother? So everyone is just going to say, well, no wonder, because he just failed at raising. And I talked to my boss, and she just said, well, really, it doesn't matter what anyone else says. You know, you were good. But everyone else that saw you were a loving mother. So just don't worry about what other people are thinking. But then the next thing was that my oldest son, he's in law enforcement, and he was already on this mental health journey to educate those in law enforcement, because that is a very, it's a very macho-driven community, and they do not talk about mental health. And he basically said to me, you know that Cedric always lived authentically, and you can't make the last thing that people will know about him something that isn't him. And that is really, and that is one of the things that I also think, that if someone lives authentically, we have to pick them up at the point where we as a family, as a community, as a society fail and don't allow them to live authentically any longer, so that they come to this point that they feel that this is the end of the road for them. And so we publicized it. Well, we didn't publicize it. Our older son wrote the obituary, and it was beautiful, and it was very clear that Cedric had died by suicide. And then the other amazing thing for me happened was then when I went back to work, so the first day back in the office, a lot of the partners came up to my office. I was on the 51st floor in Houston, and they all have to come up if they want to see me. And they came up, and there were so many that gave me a hug and closed the door and said, I'm so glad that you said that. And I went through the same thing, or I went through something like that, or I have that issue in the past, and I'm just so glad that you talk open about it, because the worst thing that we can do in a situation like that, when something this horrible happens, is that we don't even, that we just bury it and pretend that everything was okay, because it wasn't okay. And that's why I heard those numbers, but I am also hopeful that actually those that were the older partners, and some of them were really the more senior partners, that they know that it's important, and they will, if you take them by their word, if you really talk open to them about it, they will not just listen, they are empathetic, and there is a lot of things that can be done, but it's just to get them to this step where they just say, well, this is not just a person down the road, that is someone that works in our firm that has going through something like that, and actually it's not so far off from my own experience.
Now, Saskia, I know all stories are personal and unique, but I was wondering, you've now had, you know, some 4 years to kind of think about this. Are there any personal insights that you have that you can share with us on, if someone were to have a coworker that's running into a similar situation? I think a lot of us are scared to say the wrong thing. Is there, something that we could do, or something that you can suggest that, don't be afraid to do, X, Y, or Z? Any insights on that?
First, I think you need to take the cue from them, because people can be, they might not, there are some that really don't want to talk about it, they're not, and that's that's okay. That's their grief journey. But if you, one of the things that I always find very important is to take concrete action. So instead of just saying, well, I'm so sorry and tell me what you need, just say, well, I'm going to take you for a cup of coffee so you can talk. Or I'm going to, let's just take the dogs. We're going out for a walk. You can bring them food, which is something wonderful in this culture that it's not the status in all cultures. I mean, I'm German, and in Germany, you do not bring food. But I think that it is something very, it is something that is very much appreciated, because in those situations, you really don't want to think about that, but you still need nourishment. And it's also, most people that are grieving, they do want to talk about their loved ones, especially if it is such an abrupt going, passing, because it's, don't be afraid to ask about that person. Just say, well, if you, what's the most wonderful thing that you miss about that person? Or just not even ask, but say, well, I loved his way to give hugs. It's just things like that. That's something that is very personal that you know. But then also don't come with platitudes like, oh, I'm so sorry. I know what you're going through because my great grandmother died with 98. That is very different from having a younger person passing.
One of the things I took away from the story, Saskia, is that just, you know, the empathy that you were speaking of in terms of your coworkers that came to you to talk to you. This wasn't, an initiative or anything like that. This was just, you know, people being human and acting in a human way.
Yeah, definitely. And that was the most wonderful thing that can come out of something so horrific, where you just see that the people that you worked with for years and years, they really see you as a person and not just as a name on an email.
I think a key in all of this is lawyers being able to live out their lives, you know, honestly, authentically, and be able to talk about these things and not be afraid of them. Yeah.
Well, Saskia, thank you for...
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Saskia. Sharing that. Yeah, it took us 2 weeks to prepare ourselves for that too. So, Bree, I think you have a story to share as well.
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit different. And Saskia, I just want to say thank you so much for your courage to share that story. You have helped people. You really have in that act. And I know it's a sacrifice, but so my story really comes, is a little bit different, and it's about going through an alcohol use disorder and recovery from that. So just to give you the top highlights, lowlights, I had a lot of adverse childhood experience events. We'll go into that as a young child, but then by the time I got to law school, I was already experiencing depression and anxiety. When I got my grades from the first semester, I ended up with a panic disorder, rampant imposter syndrome, certain that I had, mistaken been made that I was there. I didn't drink before I got to law school, but once I did, I kind of, piled on what everybody else is doing. To self-medicate is basically what we're doing, really uncomfortable feelings of depression and anxiety and fear, et cetera. I got out of law school. I went to work doing domestic violence work, so represented victims of domestic violence and victims of child abuse, and did that for over a decade. And so you can imagine burnout, compassion fatigue, which is something that we didn't know anything about that at the time. And so at the time, I started out and I was drinking 2 glasses of wine a night. And so just to fast forward, and we know that this is disease, is something that is progressive without interruption. And by the time I was 45, I was drinking 2 bottles of wine a night, which is unsustainable on every level. It wasn't too long after that, I lost my marriage. Unfortunately, like I've seen a lot of lawyers do, losing a marriage is not enough to get in recovery. It's when it affects your career. And when I lost my job, that is when I was willing to get into recovery. And I threw myself into it because I had such an incredible level of shame. I would go into the AA meetings and sit there for months and just with my head in my hands, I couldn't even look at people all I could do was look at the floor. I was really fortunate. I got into 12-step. I threw myself into meditation, going to psychotherapy, doing everything you're supposed to do. And about a year later, still unemployed, I had the opportunity to go work at the Lawyer's Assistance Program in Texas. So there couldn't be a better job for somebody who is new to sobriety to live it and be surrounded in it every day. And so I just had a lot of opportunities that came from that and ultimately be in a leadership and a founding role around the well-being movement. And I feel like it's, you know, all of those adverse experiences and those difficulties really just led me to this point. And I am so grateful in so many ways for having the opportunity to try and make things a little bit better for others in the profession.
Well, we definitely appreciate that.
Bree, I know you said it took the losing of your job before you realized that, you know, this is something that you better get control of because it's got control of you.
Right.
Are there things that you think that law firms or businesses are doing better now to kind of, instead of cutting someone loose, to identify that there's an issue and step in and at least offer some assistance, whether the person takes it or not? Are we doing better at that?
I think we are doing better, particularly at the bigger firms where you have a professional HR staff and there's an growing understanding that this is a disease and that it is, though manageable, long-term recovery is very possible. And so it's also a protected status, being an alcoholic, an addict. And so I've seen there's much more willingness to sit down and give the person a chance and work with them. Say, you know, we want you to go through this treatment program and then come back to us and we'll look at integrating you back into the law firm. And that happens now. 15, 20 years ago, I don't think it did. It was either just ignore it and pray that there's not some massive malpractice that's going to be committed by this person, or just go in and cut them loose and let them go.
Nita, I wanted to come back to you and talk about, because I think over the last 10 years, I think there's been a push to be much more proactive on mental health, physical health, things that aren't just seen as, you know, improving the efficiency of workers through, you know, more work, but rather through better lifestyle, you know, understanding people as they come to you and finding ways to help kind of the overall wellness of the workers. We tend to go through these cycles, however, these swings to where, you know, it's like everyone's on board with it. And then all of a sudden you get someone that says, you know, we're spending way too much time. We're not getting enough return on our investment here. Or worse, you know, this is a bunch of fluff and has no place in the workplace. Are we at that point now, or have we been at that point? Or are you seeing kind of a pushback on it?
I think if there is any pushback, it would mostly be related to the notion that, like you said, that well-being is kind of a fluffy topic. And again, I think it's really a matter of what Bree said, reframing and helping people to understand how it's really about optimization for ourselves as individuals and, you know, personally and professionally, and also for the organizations themselves or the organizations that we represent. I think that when we think about well-being from the standpoint of how it drives employee engagement and it drives organizational energy, that's when you start to think of it in a non-fluffy way. I think it facilitates creativity and empathy, which is vital for constant innovation and evolution in any industry. So I think that the pushback that we feel or sense right now is less so around the acknowledgement that it's an important focus and really more now on what is the actual strategy and investment that we need to make to implement, to start managing and improving amongst what feels like other urgent priorities. And so I often will say, like, I just feel so strongly that we can't let the urgent crush the important, and we have to keep the well-being movement as and think about it in that reframed sense of how foundational it is to performing optimally, which any human being and any organization should be prioritizing as like the number one thing.
I like that. We can't have the urgent crush the important. I like that.
So what are next steps? We are seeing, you know, the wellness movement take hold in firms and in the legal industry. So what are next steps that we should be taking?
I mean, I believe that training programs, we already talked about kind of breaking the stigma and talking about it. Yes, 100%. But I also believe that training programs starting in schools, law schools, all the way through professional development in the firm has to adapt to equip individuals with not just the skills that they need to like do the job itself, like the technical skills, but also kind of those human skills. And I think we have to do a much better job of assessing where people are on their individual journeys and what this actually means for the collective whole of the teams that they're on and the organizations that they contribute to in the big. Because honestly, like what gets measured gets managed. We need to understand from our employees, like where our organizations measure in areas of like organizational health and stress and fulfillment and psychological safety and mental health and manager support and leadership support. And then I think we need to take that information that we glean and the insights that we glean from what our people are actually seeing, and then equip the leaders and the individuals to role model the behavior that's going to enable for real systematic change.
I think just really honing in, I think it is around leadership training and changing attitudes there and making sure that it's consistent across the board and, you know, with depth within the organization. And so really paying a lot of attention to helping the leaders of the firm understand what these issues are, to come up with ideas on how they can maybe look at what's happening internally. Is there any process, procedure, et cetera, that may be hampering people's willingness to go look for help? What are they doing internally that can either be helping or hindering people's well-being?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that leadership has to take ownership of the whole topic about mental health and not just push it off and make it about someone else and say, well, if you need help, but also everyone needs to be mindful and everyone has to make sure that their mental health is in good check. And that is something that can be communicated, whether you're in an acute situation where that's not the case, or you're feeling good right now, just to acknowledge that everyone has their down moments at time or doesn't feel so good about themselves. So just not just pushing it off to someone else to say it, but being open about it. And I know that's hard, especially in a profession where so much depends on being the tough person on the other side. But I think that's important, and especially when we think about what it will bring in the end, that those, if we have people that we work with that are glad to come to work, whether they're in the best place of their life or not, they're just, it's a good place for them to be. That is, that's going to show up in the tax returns.
Well, Saskia Melhorn, Bree Buchanan, and Nita Kumela, I want to thank all of you for taking the time to share such an important story and discussion with us today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so
much.
Thank
you. Thank you.
And I want to thank all of our listeners for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at Gebauer M on Twitter, LinkedIn, and at mgebauer66 on Threads.
And I can be reached on LinkedIn and at Glambert on Twitter or Glambert Pod on Threads. Saskia, if someone wants to reach out to you, where can you be found online?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn and then I'm on Twitter at SIOSLO at .com, I think. No, it's not .com.
We'll put that link we'll put the links on there. Nita?
You can probably best find me on LinkedIn, and I was just looking up my Twitter handle, and it's at Nita Camello on Twitter.
Oh, nice and easy. Yeah. Hey, Bree, how about you?
And I'm on LinkedIn, Bree Buchanan. Just put that in the search engine. And also Bree at prkrill.com.
And don't forget that we, The Geek and Review, are also on YouTube at youtube.com/@TheGeekandReview. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.